Brzezinski, who is the national security advisor to President Carter, gets what has to be the most chilling and nightmarish call you can get as a national security advisor. Bill Odom, his military advisor, calls him and says, there are 200 missiles heading towards the United States right now. You got to wake up the president and you're going to have to make a decision.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to firsthand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. I speak with Brian Knappenberger, the director of Turning Point, The Bomb and the Cold War, a 9-part documentary series on Netflix that provides a comprehensive appraisal of the events that led to the Cold War and traces the conflict around the world through the decades and beyond to the present day. Here's a 3-minute taster of what to expect.
The Cold War was the first war in history that held the possibility of ending in apocalypse.
The United States is the only country to have ever used an atomic weapon in warfare. These weapons changed the fate of the 20th century. They were so big and so destructive, they couldn't be used. It would have been a suicide pact. So instead, the Cold War was conducted through economic means, psychological means.
They envisioned the entire world Sovietized, communist style.
And through proxy battlefields across the world.
It created a need for secret activity that never went away.
The plan was to hit every city in Russia and China. It struck me as the most evil plan. This is institutional insanity.
The world, in many ways, faces a much more fraught nuclear landscape today than it has since the 1980s.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
There was a lot of questions associated with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
What would it mean for a nuclear power to come undone?
Several hundred kilograms of nuclear materials have never been accounted for. My automobile mechanic asked me if I'd like to buy some uranium. Enough for 24 nuclear weapons.
Putin said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the worst geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century.
The Cold War did end, but we are living through a new Cold War.
We're in a much worse place than we were in the Cold War. Cold War was cold. This is a unstable hot war, which could lead to catastrophic outcomes.
Brian, welcome to Cold War Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I have so enjoyed the series. Incredible how you've managed to pack more than 80 years of history into 9 episodes. Obviously, there's a few bits you've missed, you know, you can't fit everything in. But I guess where I wanted to start was, how much did you know about the Cold War before you started this project?
Well, I've always been fascinated by it and constantly kind of reading about it and obsessed with it. And of course, I'm old enough to have lived through a chunk of it myself. And, you know, my childhood, I have a kind of personal connection, especially to nuclear weapons. And so it's always been in the background of my life, I feel like, for a long time. But at the same time, this was quite an effort. This was a very big culmination of a huge team doing research over 2 years. In order to just, you know, really dig into this history at a granular level and find people in the middle of it that would be the most kind of accurate and interesting and engaging to talk to about this history and give the most sort of insight to it. Because you're right, you know, when you start a project like this, 9 hours seems like plenty of time. And, you know, 5 minutes after you embark on a journey like this, you realize, oh, I need 20 or 30 hours to do this right. So it was a massive research effort, and it was a journey of trying to make it as concise and as relevant as we possibly could in that amount of time.
Yeah, well, I have the luxury of recording as long as I like, and it's now something like 400 hours of audio there is with this project. So yeah, I'm a great admirer in that you've managed to tell this story in a really effective way. Why did you decide that this story needed to be told now?
Well, I mentioned I sort of started this really thinking a lot about nuclear weapons and trying to understand the current threat of nuclear weapons right after we'd started this. Trump had let the INF treaty lapse. You know, INF treaty is a really big deal, intermediate range nuclear missile treaty. Big accomplishment of the Cold War, really. It was looked at as one of the positive aspects of the Cold War. And particularly, of course, important for people in Europe because those are those intermediate range missiles that hit them. Capitals of Europe. So Trump had let this lapse, which seemed incredibly dangerous, and he had slow rolled the adaption, the kind of renewal, the talks on the new START treaty, which is a pretty important treaty itself. And that almost lapsed when President Biden came into office. They renewed that within a couple of weeks of entering office. And so we were at the cusp, it looked like, of being for the first time in nearly 50 years, of not having any treaties that govern the employment of nuclear weapons. So I initially came into it thinking about it with that kind of mindset. But I guess 2 months or so into the creation of this series, Putin invaded Ukraine and we were just glued to the screen. I had made a film about Ukraine in 2005 and tanks were rolling towards Kyiv and there was an assassination attempt on Zelensky's life. And it was just a really gripping moment. And it just kind of seized us, you know, that it became about that. The series really became about that. And this question, what is the Cold War really over? Was it ever over really? What were the decisions made after the collapse of the Soviet Union is the end of the Cold War? What do those decisions after that mean? How'd they lead us to this moment? It felt like history was roaring back into our lives in a very real way. So that sort of changed the course of the series, and we realized we were telling this current story about. And by the way, Putin is telling a version of the Cold War story himself, only it's riddled with all sorts of lies. So there needed to be a little counter to that narrative that he's telling. You know, he famously said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the worst geopolitical tragedy in history. So when all of that came together, that's really when it sort of crystallized that we were telling a story that was very much relevant to today.
Yeah. And I think nowadays, well, for me, from living through the Cold War, the danger seems greater because throughout the Cold War, there was never a war, hot war in Europe, albeit a proxy hot war as it is currently. We never had that situation. And, you know, the fact there's missiles and aircraft and artillery flying around right on the border of NATO makes it even more fraught.
100%. It feels more dangerous. We're back to things that have their roots in the Cold War and are clearly tensions that were born out of that period. And we're experiencing things that are new too. It's very much a hot war right now. You know, when you listen to Putin and to some of his speeches, of course, he talks often about the borders of the Soviet Union, or even a little deeper than that into the Russian Empire. He talks about these things with kind of nostalgia. He uses a lot of the tactics of the Cold War, right? Misinformation and disinformation. And there's, of course, this kind of nuclear saber rattling that we get every few days, it seems like. Certainly at the end of last week, he had talked about that. But it's also kind of different. I mean, we even at the height of the Cold War, you can look at the Cuban Missile Crisis and say, well, there's a lot of bluster happening there. You know, that played out in public and there's a lot of back and forth. But it wasn't quite the same as this. You know, this is people on Russian television, state-sponsored Russian television saying, you know, what would it take to blow up London? What kind of missile would blow up London? Having actual graphic depictions of this, joking about it. You didn't see this sort of casual kidding about it in quite the same way. This is something that's different. And of course, you're right. This is the first time that there has been this sort of a war like this in a very long time. So we're experiencing something new, but it's not, you know, every way you look at it, it's tied to Cold War tensions in some way.
Absolutely. And the history of of the Cold War, as you say, directly links into the situation we're in at the moment. There's different optics from each side, but it all comes back to decisions that were made with the Cold War. And, you know, certainly from Putin's side, contriving to tell a story that justifies what he's doing in Ukraine. One of the standout moments for me from many standout moments in there was the Munich Security Conference 2007, where Putin gives that speech. Robert Gates is within yards of him. And there's some massive close-up of Gates as Putin basically lays in to the US. And this is almost the start of him using this sort of alternative narrative, isn't it, for Putin?
Yes, I agree. It's a very dramatic moment. I vaguely knew about it before we started this, but watching those speeches and watching that reaction, it really is, it just pops with resonance for where we are now when you go back and look at it. You know, I think we took Putin, you know, we didn't think of him as a threat. You know, there's a famous line in an American debate, you know, presidential debate between Obama and Mitt Romney, where Obama lays this zinger on Mitt Romney, who is talking about Russia being a threat. And Obama says, the 80s called, they want their foreign policy back. And this is a major applause.
Wow.
I was applauding, and everybody thought, oh, they got him. Yeah, he got him, Mitt Romney, with that one. But of course, Mitt Romney was right, and we were not paying attention to Putin. This is 2008, same time frame. But that Munich conference is fascinating. You have him laying out his vision for Europe. I mean, you have him just saying what he believes and thinks and has acted on consistently since then, and maybe before then. So you have a very consistent vision. He's laying out this kind of dark speech. He's sitting there. Robert Gates is sitting right there. What's also extraordinary is he's sitting next to Angela Merkel, and then he's sitting next to Viktor Yushchenko, who he, by most accounts, most likely poisoned with dioxin poisoning, who had incredibly survived this horrific poisoning and had become the president of, overturned a fraudulent election to become the president of Ukraine. He's sitting next to him. So here you have Putin, Angela Merkel, Viktor Yushchenko all sitting right next to each other. And then on the other side of just this small aisle, you have Robert Gates and some of the other Americans. And he gives this dark speech, and he comes out and gives this kind of smile and handshake to Robert Gates and says, he describes it as just saying, yeah, great speech, great, you know, or we'd love to have you in Moscow or something. So sometimes history has these moments that just kind of are like a crystal ball into what we are about to see. And that seems like one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, with something the size of, you know, these years, I mean, I worked it out, it's probably about over 80 years, because you go back into sort of like Russian Revolution and the rise of Stalin as well. So it's 80, 90 years. How do you start to put that together?
That's a good question. It was extremely ambitious, audaciously ambitious. It's really a culmination of a 2-year effort, incredible team. You know, the showrunner, the Sarah Houston guy, is just unbelievable. And we just had a great team that dug into this history. And we were able to find, we were lucky, lots of people wanted to talk to us about this and kind of understood where we were going and trying to understand Cold War history. It was clear that, and how it related to the modern kind of moment that we're in. And so a lot of people said yes to these interviews. And so we just kind of dug in and went for it. And I think, you know, we were well along the path before we realized just how insanely audacious this was. And so we just had to, you know, we just kept up. I mean, you know, it's just such important history. It's so interesting. A lot of the effort was, where do you dig in? Where do you spend some time, and where do you kind of connect it to the next sort of series of events? But it is an epic story. I think it's the story of the human race after the human race invents a weapon that can kill all of us. The human story intersects with a technological advancement and the creation of nuclear weapons. And that changes everything that comes after. And that's really the the kind of point of this. It's, you know, we have a earth destroying, species destroying weapon, and it just sends massive reverberations and a ripple effect through the rest of history.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you have some really personal connections in there. I think one of the things that particularly touched me was the call with Brzezinski.
Yeah, that's a very, very dramatic Cold War moment. Brzezinski, who is the national security advisor to President Carter, gets what has to be the most chilling and nightmarish call you can get as a national security advisor. Bill Odom, his military advisor, calls him and says, there are 200 missiles heading towards the United States right now. You got to wake up the president and you're going to have to make a decision at some point. And he says, it's middle of the night. Okay, get more better confirmation. He hangs up, gets a call back from Bill Odom, and Bill Odom says, actually, we were mistaken. It's not 200, it's 2,000. And they're, you know, you have about 7 to 10 minutes to make this decision. So, you know, he gets ready to, he prepares himself to call President Carter and give him the recommendation to retaliate, send the missiles. And, you know, which by the way is very dangerous with, you know, the chain of command with nuclear weapons is very, very strict. You know, once they're sent, you don't, it's, the system is designed so that you don't get to call them back. You can't stop it once it's done. So that would have been nuclear war. And he's, as he's sitting there thinking about it, there's, he writes later in a book that he sees his wife there sleeping and he decides and thinks about it and decides, his wife and kids, and he decides to, he's not going to wake her up. Because why, you know, why subject her to that? Why not let her die peacefully in her sleep if we're still going to be a nuclear holocaust? And just as he's kind of having this thought, he gets a call back and says, actually, sorry, false call. It was a 40-cent computer chip that had somehow malfunctioned. And sorry about that. So don't worry about it. Go back to bed. And so, yeah, it's quite a moment, but it underlines the danger of nuclear weapons, and specifically even if you get out of the conversation of erratic leaders potentially attacking each other, you've got this massive landscape of potential human error and mistakes and computer error and all sorts of things that could go wrong that could be cataclysmic. And the scariest thing is that that's 1980. By 1983, there's so many of these things that we find out later, so many misunderstandings, so many things that are the rhetoric is so dramatically escalated at that point. Reagan's called the Soviet Union even an evil empire. So that a lot of people think of it, 1983 as the most dangerous period in all of human history. So there's the rhetoric between the leaders, there's the bluster, and then there's the reality of the fact that just as a human species, we got a lot of these things laying around and a lot of stuff can go wrong.
And it's just one of many near misses throughout the Cold War. I had Brian Mora on Cold War Conversations last
year. Oh, yeah.
In fact, I was pleased to see there were at least 4 guests that I'd had on Cold War Conversations in your documentary.
Good. So, we must be doing something right.
Well, yeah. I felt that was a pretty good hit rate. But, I mean, how did you then refine down what interviewees you were going to actually go with? Because it sounds like you did a load of interviews which didn't make the final cut as well.
That's true. We did. There are over, I think there's over 100, like something like 114 interviews in the series. But I think we were looking at people that were just in the middle of Cold War history. So the people that were either policymakers or officials like Robert Gates or Condoleezza Rice, or, you know, we have 4 current or former heads of state, I think, in the series. So we wanted that perspective. We wanted the perspective of historians and academics and experts that can kind of bring us back there and think in a bigger picture way about what was happening and kind of set the stage for us. And then we wanted people that were not policymakers and whose just direct personal lives were affected in some way by the Cold War. So it was a process of kind of thinking that through with those sorts of filters to get at the right, because, you know, it's true that the Cold War touched all of us, touched everybody's life that lived through it and is touching everybody still. And so, but we wanted to sort of focus on people that were sort of in the middle or as close as possible to this history.
Yeah, and it definitely works. I mean, really my ethos with the podcast is to try and capture Cold War histories, the personal first-person accounts of their experiences. And sometimes it's, you know, policymakers, but a lot of the time it's people whose just regular life is directly affected by the Cold War. And in some ways that makes it more relatable because you can sort of get your head around what they were experiencing.
Yeah. I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. And, you know, one of the testimonies that I found really interesting was Daniel Ellsberg, who sadly is no longer with us, but you've captured some amazing accounts from him about his experiences.
Yeah, I agree. That's a high point, I think, of the series. I have interviewed him before. I've met him a bunch of times. I think I've done two other interviews with him before that. We talked for a couple of maybe 3 hours. I think it was the last long form video interview of him about definitely about nuclear weapons before he died. And he's quite a obviously a critical historical figure. I mean, what he told us is he describes that, you know, when he'd come forward with the Pentagon Papers, which is this such a kind of seminal moment in history, he believed he was going to jail for the rest of his life for that, and that he was going to at the same time release the nuclear plans that he had basically done the same thing, where he had sort of collected over time and had done this sort of meticulous process of recording and Xeroxing. I mean, we all kind of know the Pentagon Papers story. He did the same thing with the nuclear plans. There was some incident or some sort where he lost them, but he believed that those were much more important than what he had done with the Pentagon Papers. And so he spent most of his life being an anti-nuclear weapons kind of advocate, protester. And he's just got such obvious courage. And he was such an insider at these moments, especially at RAND and all these other points where he got access to this stuff. And he has such a conscience about what's right and what's wrong and how to really kind of look at this. And he led a life of courage, and an important historical figure who's on the inside. And there just aren't that many people who have that level of courage. There just aren't. You know, there aren't that many people who can see the inside of how things are working, can make a judgment call about them being right or wrong, and then have the courage to break ranks and to go out and to really speak about it. And I have a weird personal connection to nuclear weapons. I mentioned it's in Rocky Flats. I can talk about that if you want. But when I was a kid, it was the first time I ever was aware of him at all as a figure, is when he came and he did protests at Rocky Flats. And so it's, you know, I just think he's an extraordinary person. You know, as a friend, I hope I can have called him that, but I interviewed him 3 times. And I just think he had a real truth that not a lot of people are courageous enough to come forward with, even if they have it.
Yeah. I mean, for some bizarre reason, I not come across him. I think he's probably more well known in the US than over here. But that was a fascinating story and made me do a bit more research on the subject. And, you know, this is something I always hope with the podcast, and certainly I hope with your documentary as well, is it will pique people's interest in this period and dig into more detail, because as we said right at the start, you're limited with time constraints as to how deep you can go. Were there any particular events that you found especially fascinating but were unable to cover due to time constraints?
I think that lots is the short answer, but I guess
give me the highlights.
The highlights, I think that there's a lot more to be said and unpacked about proxy wars around the world. We did more with the story of Chile. We did a number of other stories that we had that we just didn't have time to really go into, and deserve in a lot of ways their own series, kind of unpacking their own series. So, there's a lot there. I hope we did it justice, or at least explained the dynamics, if not the specific story details. But I think that's probably the most biggest answer to your question. I feel like there's a lot of stuff, and we were actually thinking about drilling down on future projects in that area. The other one is bioweapons, which I just feel like is an interesting, that doesn't quite fit into a series like this, but is also a very important subject.
Well, it's like you cover the active measures of the Soviet intelligence services.
Yeah.
I've always found the whole AIDS scare story fascinating.
Completely fascinating. I mean, it's a really relevant for our modern moment. Yeah. I mean, we found the person whose job it was to try to track that down. And so she goes about this multi-year effort to try to track down what the origins of that AIDS story, the story is that the CIA created and planted AIDS, created the AIDS crisis. And this surfaces in the 80s. And when you start to track through, it's a lot to be learned about how misinformation moves. When you start to track how this became part of the discussion, these things are published in a small newspaper somewhere in the world. Another newspaper somewhere in the world will reference it or talk about it as a source and then run with it. And that becomes a new source. And meanwhile, the original source disappears somehow. It's not even there anymore. And suddenly this thing takes on a life of its own. This is in the 80s, of course, pre-internet. And this is a piece of misinformation that's planted by the KGB. But it gets so much momentum that Dan Rather, one of the top newscasters in the world, certainly in the United States, it's not exaggerated. Yeah, you know, Dan Rather is a major deal in the United States.
Don't worry, Brian, I've heard of it.
Yeah, but there's a lot of newscasters in the world. But no, he's a very important, obviously, there's only three major networks in the United States at the time. Dan Rather is a big deal. He actually mentions it on the nightly news, which is about as successful as a story like this can ever be. And so she tries to figure this out. She tries to go back, and it's amazing the level that she goes to in order to understand this story, how it travels, the misinformation travels. And then, is it true? And she has access to all these biolabs and all of these various, she has all this high level clearance that most people don't have. And it takes her almost 2 years. And, you know, surprise, surprise, there's nothing to this story. It's not real. That's not a real thing. But, you know, it takes an expert with access to debunk this thing. And 2 years is this extraordinary period of time. We live in a period of time now, of course, where 15 minutes of a fake story is enough to do damage. And the truth lags behind it pretty, you know, by weeks or months. So again, I mean, you tell this story of the Cold War and these stories of the tools of the Cold War and the kinds of things that were done mostly because of the threat of nuclear weapons, right? Because you can't have a nuclear war. These tensions have to do these other weird things, proxy wars and disinformation, all this stuff, and espionage. Those have to be your tools since you can't use military might in the same way anymore. But every turn, every storyline feels like the world we live in. It just doesn't feel like you're telling a historical story here. It feels like this is the story of our time and our moment. This isn't World War II in color or something. This is the story of our world today.
Absolutely. There's so many of these stories that resonate with experiences that we've had today. It's eerie, actually, the more you go through the series,
really?
And think, I've heard this before, but in a different...
Yeah, almost it feels like last week.
Yeah.
I know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Were there any poignant or surprising things you came across where you had that sort of like, wow moment? I never knew about this.
Yeah, lots of those sorts of things. Well, you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg, the numbers and the plan. When you really go through that, you know, 600 million people potentially dying, you know, like, and this is just the plan. You know, when there are moments that are chilling and absolutely shocking about what he said. I was surprised at Andy Weber's story when he, you know, after
the
breakup
Sapphire
of the Soviet Union, Project Sapphire. Yeah. That's quite a story. That Project Sapphire was a U.S., you know, it was a government program to go and track down nuclear weapons. So once and nuclear materials and nuclear expertise in the form of people, and to try to understand what happened after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So, I mean, instantly you have, instead of one superpower of the Soviet Union, that turns into four different nuclear states. And, you know, Kazakhstan, you've got, you know, of course, Russia, you've got Ukraine, which is a really important issue. And so he is part of the mission that goes into Kazakhstan and tries to sort of track what's happening here. This is a chaotic moment, and nuclear weapons are pretty critical, and you don't want them getting into the wrong hands. And so you're dealing with lots, it's even beyond the four, but you're dealing with lots of different entities somehow that have a piece of this puzzle. And so he's part of this effort to do this, and he manages to negotiate a deal. The U.S. government manages to negotiate a deal with the government of Kazakhstan to get back a lot of this nuclear weapons materials. And in a very complicated series of events, transports this. We go through this in the film. It's remarkable footage of this. It's crazy. It's crazy. You've got these big vats of this nuclear material, and they're on these like old, you know, like... I look like 50s era trucks that are kind of slipping and sliding on the ice, and they put them in these planes and they take them to the United States. And, you know, the civilian power use in the United States was created from this weapons materials that were kind of errant after the collapse of the Soviet
Union. So it is a real swords into plowshares sort of story in the end. But you're right. I mean, they're worried about security driving this stuff to the airport, that it might get intercepted and somebody will steal it and sell it to the highest bidder. And it's high drama, and it's all been filmed as well. But I think the other thing off the back of that, you mentioned Ukraine, and Ukraine inherited nuclear weapons with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Now, they were willing to give up some of their nuclear weapons, but they weren't willing to give up all of them. And in the end, the West sort of strong-armed them into giving up them all. And Ukraine insisted that the treaty, including Russia, would have to include that their borders would never be violated if they gave up these nuclear weapons, or something to that effect.
Yep. This is a very important moment, especially when you think about Russia invading Ukraine now and this sort of mismatch in artillery there. I mean, small moments in history make a big deal, become very big deals later. When the Soviet Union collapsed, one nuclear power becomes four new nuclear powers. So it's Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. And Ukraine is now, just overnight, the third largest nuclear power in the world. But it's true, Ukraine was pressured to give up its weapons in something called the Budapest Memorandum. And they're very nervous about this. They don't want to give up their nuclear weapons because they believe one day Russia will invade them, and they want to have this protection. And they do this with an assurance from the United States. The United States is keen to do this because they are part of this effort to try to contain the number of countries that have nuclear weapons and to simplify the management of these weapons. And it's viewed that Russia is not a threat anymore after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that it's better for Russia to be in control of these things. Russia always had command and control of these weapons, although the Ukrainians could have figured this out. in other words, the missiles in Ukraine and the control of Russia, this could have been solved. But we just looked at Russia as not being a threat and that this would simplify control of nuclear weapons. So Ukraine reluctantly gives up these nuclear weapons for an assurance from the United States that if Russia were to invade or something were to happen to them, that the United States would intervene on their behalf. This is an assurance as opposed to a guarantee. And a lot's been made about those words recently and the difference between those words. So guarantee means there's American soldiers on the ground in Ukraine now and the military's coming and probably Russia doesn't invade in the first place. An assurance means we got your back, but we're not bound to it. And so, I feel like a recurring theme of this conversation in this series is you get these little moments. It's like a laser is just focused on a moment in time. And in that moment of time, you get this blinding vision of what might come. And that is what happened. A lot goes back to that Budapest memorandum. A lot goes back to that. And really small decisions made at these critical moments have this ripple effect that becomes much bigger later. It's true with NATO. It's true with any number of things that could have probably easily avoided what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it's always easy to look back with hindsight. And I get the U.S. position to reduce proliferation of these weapons and make the security of them better. But that is a real fascinating, relatively unknown piece of what was happening post-Cold War. I think that almost post-Cold War, that post-Soviet Union being dissolved is a fascinating period because there's so much in flux there and so much moving quite quickly to just try and secure not just nuclear weapons, but the independence of these countries. I always find it fascinating I've done a number of interviews with people from Estonia. And, how a country, which one moment is communist or state socialism, becomes a free country, how they manage their currency, their economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the latter part of the series talks about how we essentially let Russia and its economy fall apart, which has directly resulted in some of the feelings in Russia that they need a strong man every time in government to keep Russia great and keep everything going.
Yeah. In the series, a lot of people, I think, look at the collapse of the Soviet Union as the end of the Cold War. And I think the main premise of this series is that that's just an event that happened. And that we're still very much in the middle of those same tensions. There's a famous book called The End of History, that was written about that time. And George H.W. Bush in the present State of the Union address says, Cold War's over and we won, and there's great resounding applause. But it's not the end of history, obviously. History doesn't end like that. This was a new period. And the decisions that were made right after that really define where we are now, I think. There was a series of advisors that came in and had this kind of shock therapy approach. They just this absolute shift, overnight shift as quickly as you possibly could to a capitalist system. And this leads to real hardship for people in Russia. And the economy collapses. And, there is a period of real excitement with the possibilities of democracy that everybody feels, including people in Russia, but they become disillusioned over time in the 90s. And ultimately start to see capitalism and democracy as a bad thing, a very bad thing, and start having second thoughts about this. And there's a real unrest there because people are hungry. And it is multiple difficult periods of economic hardship there. So the United States, I think we did think it was the end of history. The United States turned away from there and probably should have doubled down on aid on figuring out how to make that work. There's a pretty famously, Cold War is the Warsaw Pact versus NATO countries, right? Warsaw Pact disappears the minute that the Soviet Union collapsed. It's over. But NATO continues, right? What? NATO is a child of the Cold War. And George H.W. Bush basically says, if it's not broken, don't fix it. some decisions could have been made about NATO, including Russia or not, trying to figure some stuff. George W. Bush famously said, "I don't do the vision thing." That's a line that President H.W. Bush said. Well, that's a hell of a moment in history to not be doing the vision thing. We had, if he's right, we had won the Cold War. The equipment had been made. The weapons had been made. The protests had happened. All we actually needed was vision. That's actually all we needed at that point. And that was, so we didn't have that. And President Clinton comes in. And of course, for him, it's the economy, stupid, right? It's that mentality where this is done. It's time for us to focus on a kind of national, a kind of a nationalist approach. So, you know, this is a great tragedy. It is a tragedy. It's a tragedy that more wasn't made out of that moment. That, and, you know, Robert Gates just, I think, has a really moving section of his interview where he says and it's extraordinary to hear him say it, that, you know, we underestimated the humiliation that probably the Russians felt at that moment, that we didn't pay enough attention to that. And there's no question that's true. And that led to the conditions that allowed an authoritarian figure like Putin to come onto the world stage.
Yeah, it's one of those great what ifs. You know, what if there had been some sort of Marshall Plan for the former Soviet Union, and how that would have created much more fertile ground for democracy there and have prevented the rise of Putin. I mean, it's sort of like history always has a demagogue almost arriving in times of massive hardship in a country. I mean, Hitler sort of comes in whilst the economy is just on the rise, but that's almost where his position is. And it's very similar with Putin, is that the country's gone to the dogs, and he's going to bring it all back together and sort it. I mean, he still hasn't sorted it, and he's got in a right mess with Ukraine, but there's still a large proportion of the Russian population that believe his story at the moment.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
Yeah, I think that's essentially the bargain that people understood with Putin. This was that things were hard. It was going to be tough, and things were going to get better, but it wasn't going to be a democracy. That there was a kind of unspoken thing there that people kind of understood that or craved that kind of voice. I mean, he was consistent from his early days, but he's also, you know, he got lucky with the price of oil rising too. And Russia's economy is connected very closely to that. So, you know, things improved in Russia and that emboldened him. And he has just essentially never left power. I mean, there was a period with Medvedev briefly, but, you know, as we've seen this weekend, he just got reelected again until, 2030. So we're talking about a period, somebody who will have been in power for, with the exception of the Medvedev years, close to 30 years. So, I mean, this is longer than Stalin. So yeah, this isn't a democracy, and it's been clear for quite a while.
What are your favorite parts of the series? I mean, you can't say all 9 episodes, and we've already covered Daniel Ellsberg. Are there any particular ones where you think, I could watch that many times over because it's such a fascinating part?
Your emotions always come to the surface with the Berlin Wall collapsing. Good luck getting out of that one without a little emotional resonance. I feel a little bit that way about the Orange Revolution too. I don't know. I was there a little bit for that, and I made a film about that period. You know, there is a, you know, the Baltic chain, you know, the people that at every stage, there's been people willing to stand up and to do the right thing, even if it meant it was a risk to them personally, physically or professionally or anything else. But that standing up to authoritarianism, to surveillance, to the conditions that I find kind of endlessly moving, that Leipzig moment, probably. I mean, look, that's just powerful. You know, that people, and that created the conditions that eventually the momentum that started the Berlin Wall became the Berlin Wall falling. But for people to say, I didn't know, were we going to be shot? Was it going to be the Chinese solution? Tiananmen Square had just happened. Protesters came to the streets. They were killed. Is that what was going to happen to us if we take the streets? And one person sees another person, and suddenly there's 70,000 people in a peaceful protest urging nonviolence. There's no way that many people are going to be killed. And so by sheer numbers and by sheer level of courage, you've got world change that becomes more democratic, that becomes more focused on people, on individuals, that is a pushback against these kind of oppressive forces. That stuff will never cease to get me.
I have immense admiration for people who protested in those countries. You know, I've done a number of interviews where I've been moved to tears hearing their story. And I think, you know, East Germany and the whole of Eastern Europe, nobody knew that the Berlin Wall was going to fall. If you lived there, you felt that was going to be your life for the rest of your life. And if you were in that situation, would you rock the boat? Would you do something that would mean your kids aren't going to go to university or your wife's going to lose her job or stuff like that? It's just immense bravery. And, you know, this series absolutely gives tribute to those people as well as the people at the top. I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, how do you put me in contact with Gorbachev's interpreter?
I could try to figure it out. It was tricky. We were trying to, for a brief moment, this is before Gorbachev died. I mean, we had actually thought maybe we can figure it out. But yeah, no, that was just good producing work. We managed to get him to Brussels and I interviewed him there.
He was riveting hearing his, and I'm sure he's got a load more other, he's one of those characters where you could potentially just do a whole episode on
definitely.
Him. And I'm delighted to hear that you're looking at perhaps in the pipeline, expanding out some of the Cold War subjects that you haven't been able to cover in wider areas. If there were four people who are now dead, who you could have interviewed, who would they be and why? So four people from the Cold War who you wouldn't have been able to interview because they're dead, but if you could have interviewed them, who would you choose?
Wow, that's a good question. I need to do this question justice. Who are the four that I would... I think it would be...
I should have given this to you before, so you could have had some thoughts about it. Sorry to give you this curveball towards the end of the interview.
Okay, I'll start with a couple, and I'm sure I'll think of two as I ramble. I think obvious is Gorbachev. We tried to get him. Gorbachev, and he's a remarkable figure in history. He's really phenomenally compelling historical figure. I would have loved to have interviewed him. I, of course, thought he was incredible, even in the 80s and the early 90s.
But reviled
at home. He's also complex.
But
he reviled at home, but also, even historically speaking, complex in places like Lithuania. You go to Vilnius, they blame him for bringing in tanks there and attempting to sort of put down some of the protests that were happening there militarily after he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize for his inaction, is not doing that for the Berlin Wall. So he's complex, but he is a forward-thinking person. He was somebody that saw the tides of history, understood what was happening, was reasonable about it. He didn't want the Soviet Union to collapse. He believed in the Soviet Union, but he believed people would stick with that system if given more freedoms and it was loosened, but the pressure was too great and a little bit of loosening led to cracking of the system. So that's definitely one. The second one, you know, I don't want to restrict myself to modern folks. But George Kennan, I would love to interview George Kennan. The George Kennan letter, the long telegram, that kicked it off. That really started this whole thinking about the us versus them mentality, that the new world was going to be a battle between these two superpowers that were going to fight it out for the dominion of the world, as Tim Weiner says in her piece. But I also read that George Kennan later in life regretted some of what he wrote, that he said that he saw these things happening and wanted to articulate this, but he regretted that most people took what he was saying and thought it meant only military action, that they just thought they only meant military, and that's not what he felt or intended at the time. So he wrote later about that it would have been that, you know, there's lots of other ways, cultural things, aid packages, which of course the United States and other countries did at various points in the Cold War in order to change the outcomes. But he just lamented that most people took him to mean only military action and not a whole range of other pressures that could have been applied or approaches that could have been applied. I think I would love to do an interview with. I mean, if you're just giving me carte blanche, Khrushchev. But yeah, I don't know. That's only three, though. But there's so many amazing figures. I don't know if I would interview Kennedy or even Eisenhower, but I might do
You've got names there that I would probably go for as well, but I'd love to interview Lech Walesa.
Oh, sure. Yes, of course.
And Alexander Dubček as well, the Czech,
that's
the Czech
true.
Leader at the time of the Prague Spring. Those are ones that I'd want to do. And Lech Walesa, we've still got a chance to do that as well.
We talked to him. We almost got him. But yeah, we tried to interview Hillary Clinton. I wanted to interview Hillary Clinton. She's the one that I was kind of most surprised didn't talk to us.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.